the resonance with your antenna analyzer looking through the balance. That's number one. Number two, how many turns of cable do you need, let's say, of RG8U or RG, you know, LMR400 to make a 4-man sound, let's say, at 20 megs, 30 megs? And the other thing is this, E-skip. Would you consider E-skip to be the same as F-skip as far as polarity, that you don't know which way the polarity is going to be when it comes off of E-skip, Dick?
Yeah, good questions, and I'm going to go in reverse order. The E-skip and the F-skip are both ionization phenomena, and that ion layer, the ionosphere, is a plasma. They both have a magnetic field. They're both going to be screwing up polarization. Mel's got lots of examples of where he's using what he knows to be a pure vertical antenna, talking to a guy that's claiming he's purely horizontal, and the vertical is where he gets the strongest signal, and vice versa. So we know this polarization rotation. I'm a little bit disappointed that most of the books discussing propagation don't seem to mention that. The word Faraday rotation, because Mr. Faraday, I guess, is the guy who first recognized this one, seems to be not given enough credit, so to speak, or not given enough exposure. Let me drop. And all of a sudden my mind's gone blank on the second part of what you were asking. And I had a good answer for it. What was the second part of your question, Howie?
Okay, if I have a balun, I can buy a balun in the store. If I have a balun, I'm feeding it into a dipole. Should I adjust the resonance of the antenna without the balun, or can I use my antenna analyzer or Sightmaster to look right through the balun? And the other question was, how many turns of coax should you use if you're using RG8U or LMR400? How many turns should you use if you want to feed like an unbalanced antenna? Well, let's say between 20 and 30 megs. What's the rule of thumb and diameter of the loops?
KC2QIQ with a comment.
We're going to go over to Glenn with his personal experience on how many turns. Also, the balun itself. Let me go to how many turns first. What you're doing with the turns is you're trying to make a choke for the outside of the cable without affecting the inside of the cable. Because you're trying to choke off the RF energy flowing down a 50-ohm cable, a rough rule of thumb is you'd like the inductive reactance of that coil that you're forming, the poor man's balun, to be something like 10 times 50 ohms, 500 ohms. If you can make it 5,000, even better. Your next question is, okay, how do I make 500 ohms of inductive reactance? At your particular frequency, X of L equals 2 pi FL, you can calculate the inductive reactance of a known number of microhenries at your frequency. And you've got this beautiful equation and a bunch of graphs in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where you plug in the numbers of how many turns and what's the diameter of the turns, how many microhenries do you get. So that's one approach. That's a scientific approach to choosing the right number of turns. Look for 500 ohms or above is my gut feel. But both Mel and Glenn are going to tell us their personal experience as to how big a coil and how many turns of it. And the last section was on the balun. Let me drop. If this is the best of all worlds, your balun will have exactly the input and output impedance that you desire. If it's a one-to-one balun, and you hung a perfect 50-ohm resistor on the output of the balun, then when you measure the input impedance to the balun, you're going to see exactly 50 ohms resistive. That's a perfect balun. No balun is that perfect. If I hung a perfect 50-ohm resistor on the output of a one-to-one balun, I might measure an input impedance of 53 ohms resistive and 3 ohms reactive, capacitive or inductive, depending on how the balun is designed. So it's going to have a small perturbation on the way you measure your antenna. And now you have to decide, do I want the balun plus antenna as a structure to be my radiating system, and I want it to present a good standing wave ratio in the shack, in which case you tune the two as a combination. Or, if conversely, you're using the balun to make sure you've got a pure feed to the antenna, but now you want to know the exact impedance of the antenna independent of the way you're feeding it. Now you've got to do some reverse mathematics, so to speak, to take out the effect of the balun. When I went through that calibration procedure that I described for referencing your vector network analyzer, and by the way, an antenna analyzer, let me drop. An antenna analyzer really is a scalar network analyzer. With some smarts, and it would be a little bit troublesome, but you could use your antenna analyzer through the balun into a set of loads, like a 50-ohm load, a pair of 50-ohm loads in parallel 25, a short circuit, an open circuit. You can calibrate the perturbation effect of your particular balun, and then with some smarts, using your antenna analyzer through that balun, you can figure out what was the exact impedance of your antenna, if that's what you want to know. But I think most of the time you want to tune the combination, because that's what you're going to live with. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Dick, I think you're right on the money with that. What I've found most of the time is, when I'm setting up most of the time like a dipole that I'm setting up for a mono or a single band, I'll normally cut the dipole initially just to get a starting point on a one-to-one balun. Roughly, you know, close to the quarter wavelength, you know, just using the straight, equation 468 over frequency in megahertz, and just, you know, calculate the length just to get a starting point. I'll connect it right up to the balun and then put the antenna analyzer on it and trim it right in. And it's amazing the bandwidth you get out of a dipole and how good a match you get. It usually trims so much better than trying to put it into a piece of coax at the end, or even a pair of, trying to run ladder line in a tuner. Really, really good performance. Then I've tried going with a 4-to-1 balun one time, and I found out, okay, my dipole had to get longer, but I was still able to get a good match. It's really interesting. You can tune tune the antenna on an antenna analyzer and just keep on adjusting the length, and you see, you know, if it's too low in frequency, you trim it short. If it's, you know, if you're too high in frequency, you have to add some length. But usually the match comes right in, Dick. Very, very simple to match. And that's usually tuning right through the balun with an antenna tuner. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Nancy, do you want any comments?
John, recognize you're going to be after Mel. Very few of us recognize the fact that the resistive component of a dipole is completely adjustable from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms, maybe 1,500 ohms, by doing nothing but changing the length of the dipole. Make a dipole short, and you can make it go down to 1 ohm of a resistive component if you want to. Make the dipole longer, where it approaches full wave for the full dipole, and you get well above 1,500 ohms. And every other resistive component that you desire in between. If you're using a 4-to-1 balun, and you want your dipole to be 200 ohms, you go to the Brown and Woodward curves on Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And those exact same R curves and X curves are in the article by K2RIW that's on the website of Tom Williams. Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha dot net, I think it is, or dot org. www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, I think it is. You go to his website, the bottom of the page, you'll find an article by K2RIW about tuning a dipole to make the impedance perfect at whatever impedance you want, at whatever frequency you want. Let me drop. So the first step in the process of this extremely well-kept secret, adjust the length of the dipole, the resistive component will become anything you want from 1 ohm to 1,500 ohms, inclusive. That's the good news. The bad news is, as you choose the dipole longer than the 70-ohm number, it's going to be inductive. There's going to be some reactance left over. Tune it shorter than the 70-ohm length, and it's going to be capacitive. If you're willing to put a simple shunt capacitor or a shunt inductor across the feed point and readjust the length because there's some interaction, you can make the dipole a perfect, purely resistive impedance at any number you want. If you want your dipole to be 357 ohms resistive with no reactance, you're going to make it long enough to be 357 ohms, which simultaneously makes it a little bit inductive. You're going to put a shunt capacitor across the center, and you're there. You'd be amazed how well kept a secret that is. Everybody thinks that if you want the dipole to be a higher impedance, you got to use one of these elaborate structures that looks like a T-match with two or three or four wires to it. Or you have to have different diameters for the folded dipole structure. You think you've got to mechanically do things to make the dipole some other impedance. You can do that if you like. That's the hard way. That's the traditional way. There's a hell of a lot better way. And when I tried publishing an article on that, they wouldn't publish it because we're discussing something so simple called dipole, and the publisher wasn't interested in the article. So I've been publishing it without the publisher, as you can tell. Mel, one of the things I want to ask you is, what's your favorite number of...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
What's your favorite number of turns of what diameter of coax to make a good poor man's balun at, say, for instance, 80 meters or 40 meters? Over to you, Mel. KQLIW in the TechNet, KQKEY, you got it.
Okay, this is KQKEY. Well, getting up to 80 meters and all, you know, you wind one of these things, you're going to use a lot of RGAQ to make one. It gets a little on the heavy side. But let's look at the one for, like, the Moseley beam as we finally got, not missed the call, Moseley, to sort of agree that it makes the improvement. It finally came out, the addendum, that you take 8 turns of coax RG8U at the time he, I think he had some kind of link up with Belden, because all the time, and almost every one of his, whenever he sold beam in the information of what kind, you know, the coax cable that we suggest is RG8U, Belden so-and-so number, you know, so there must have some kind of a, something tie in there. So you took the Belden, you made 8 turns, 6 inches in diameter, and in fact, you know, you put, tie it up with a bunch of ties, it's going to be outside with ties that can stand the ultraviolet, and you hang it off the boom. Was the left side of the boom? He even specified which side of the boom he wanted it on, or some goddamn thing like that. And it was the answer. That was the bottom line, Dick.
HWW, with a comment and question, Dick, on the datums?
Yeah, you're right after John. John, you want to make a further comment? Go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. NCGYN and TechNet. Yeah, I was just curious also, Mel, was this, when you had this conversation with Carl, was it around 85 to 87? Because that's when I was going back and forth with him on the same subject. And anyway, yeah, I know he came up with the, he preferred the solution of the poor man's balun, and rather than omitting that, adding a 4-to-1 balun, in other words, a completely separate apparatus, as you may say, improved his antenna. Did not want to admit it. So it was amazing to just get to the fact that, you know, well, you turn the car, here's what you do, here's the addendum, you know, and he came up with the 8-inch or the proper amount of turns. The other thing I actually wanted to make a comment on was when you're talking about the dipole and the analyzer and cutting. Let me drop it a second. What's interesting using the analyzer and cutting dipole, if you do it in an open field where there is no structures, and you use your analyzer and you cut it to exactly center frequency you want it to be, do not expect that you're going to put it then, take it down and put it in the installation at your QTH or home. And the reason for that is it reacts to different structures around. So you know, if you think you're going to get the same results at an open field as you are in, let's say, home residence where each home is maybe, you know, 25, 30 feet from each other, you're not. I mean, I remember also with the beam, I don't know how many people have done this, you know, go on any given frequency, 20, 15, 10, and look at your SWR, and key to mic on CW with dead carrier, and rotate the beam. And just watch your SWR. Watch it change, you know. All of a sudden, it's dead flat. Look at that. I got it perfect. Yeah, but now I'm turning it to the west, and now it's up to 1.5:1. But, you know, so structure and the insulation is going to change. There's all that other element in there. I remember when I would turn mine towards the power lines that were in front of my house. I went from, on the same frequency, from a 1:1 match to almost a 2:1. And all I did was rotate the beam, so... Just wanted to throw that in there. N2QI.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, you're right after Howie. John, a guy doing an academic experiment as to what's the right length of a dipole in a great big open field with high trees would be doing just that, an academic experiment, because that's not where, except for field day, that's not where he's going to use it. To tune the dipole on your property in the location where you're going to use it is the smartest thing to do. And if you did the academic experiment, you'd find out the right length of dipole at that same altitude in the field, that's the right impedance match that you're happy with, and you move it into your property, and yes, the nearby capacitive loading at the ends and the other structures around are changing it. By readjusting length and or putting a capacitor or an inductor tuning element right at the center of the dipole, can make it perfect at your frequency if you want to do that. And some of these more modern, let me drop, some of the more modern antenna analyzers measure the resistive component and the reactive component. They measure the R and the X. And if you know the length of your transmission line, and if you know how to use a Smith chart, that measurement you make in the shack will tell you exactly what's happening at the antenna. And you'll know, do you make it longer or shorter? Do you add an inductor or do you add in a capacitor? It'll tell you which way to go. I didn't say it's easy. It's going to take some training with a Smith chart or some mathematics. But just know that it's doable. These modern network analyzers, these modern antenna tuners. And even if your antenna tuner is not the kind that gives you R and X separately, as you switch the frequency of your rig and you keep track of the measurements that your simple antenna analyzer is giving you, where it just tells you what is the VisWatt component, assuming it's well calibrated. And you can check that by putting in a pair of 50 ohm resistors on a T connector, and do you get a 2:1 VisWatt, and so on. So you can check on the accuracy of your simple antenna analyzer, and by swishing the frequency, knowing when you go up, the bathtub shaped curve where your VisWatt is going down, that's telling you something very valuable. It tells you which way to go. So you'll eventually get there, and to tune it for your particular environment, I think makes the most amount of sense, because that's the way you're going to use it. Howie, go ahead. K2RIW in the second hand.
Okay. If you make the dipole longer or shorter, say using 75 or 50 ohm cable, and you get to, you find out where you get the best FWR, now you have some reactants. Now, can you change the angle, go from either a dipole to an inverted V or slightly less than horizontal? That's all. That will also affect your impedance, but that will also affect the reactants. Go ahead, Dick.
Without a doubt, it's not a major reactance change, but it is a reactance change. If Brown and Woodward, which did all their measurements on a dipole-like structure, they really did it with a monopole, but a monopole is really half of a dipole, or a dipole is a pair of monopoles back-to-back. So, had they made all of their measurements with an inverted V instead of a dipole, the family of curves would have looked similar. They'd be different, but they would have looked similar. They'd have the same trend. Shorter distance would be lower R, shorter length would be lower R, longer length would be larger R. That would have been true. Shorter length would have been more capacitive. Longer length would have been more inductive. The trends would be the same. it'd be a slightly different set of curves. So whether you've chosen dipole or inverted V, and if you know what the trend is by looking at those Brown and Woodward curves, and I just went and checked, it is www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. At the bottom of his page, you'll find the set of curves under a perfect impedance match of a Yagi or dipole, and the whole article explaining it by K2RIW. Looking at those curves will tell you exactly which way to go. And you can make your dipole a 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio in your environment on your favorite frequency if you really want to. The technology is there. Any further questions on that one, Howie? K2RIW.
No, Dick. Just going to say that, by the way, the only comment I'm going to make is that when I was on 6 meters and I've had made dipoles on 6, I found out that if you took the ends of your dipole and bent them back and make like gimmick capacitors or made loops at the end of it, you could actually get the SWR as close to 1-to-1, even though you were using 50-ohm cable going into a 75-ohm feed. I've noticed that you can actually put make capacitor hats at the end of your quarter, on each side of your quarter wave, and that would work.
Well done. When I told you about putting an inductor or a capacitor at the center of the dipole to correct for the reactive component, the more sophisticated approach is to make the end of the dipole more capacitive, if that's what you want to do. And by the way, making a capacitive top hat at the end of the dipole, which is a quarter wave on each side, a quarter wave is an impedance inverter, that is creating an inductor at the center. ain't that a kicker? Adding capacitance to the tip of a dipole is equivalent to making the center of the dipole more inductive. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple of quick comments, Dick. One is, definitely, whenever you're tuning one of these things, it's always best to tune it on location, where it's going to be used. That's the best place to really adjust the match. And I've just been so surprised with, especially one-to-one balance, how really I've never had to add a capacitor or anything else to the balance. Most of the time, just by adjusting length, I can get a match well better than 1.1 to 1 in most cases. And the other thing I've noticed, too, is that when I use a balance, like a one-to-one balance, and I'll cut it to a certain length, and it's not exactly at the right altitude yet or not perfectly fixed, it's not so much the VSWR that I'm tuning for, but I'm looking with the analyzer, I'm sweeping where the dip is taking place. In other words, there's a point to where, in frequency, where it's going to be, you'll see the dip and will come into match, and then as you sweep across, it'll come out of match again. And that sweet spot, yes, the VSWR or the dip, or where it gets to the closest match when you're too low to the ground, may not be as good a VSWR. But as you raise it into the air, all of a sudden, even as long as the frequency is in the correct area where the dip is in the right spot, generally as it's raised into location, I notice it definitely always comes in, the VSWR improves overall across the band. Another thing is that I love inverted Vs, and one of the things I've noticed there too is without having to add any capacitors or inductors or anything, is just make it a little bit longer. Typically the inverted V wants to have just a little bit more length. It gets cut there, and usually to be within, better than 1.1 to 1, never seems to be much of a stretch, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And did you want to comment?
John and Howie in that order. Yeah, as you take a flat-out dipole and start curving it down into an inverted V, the resistive component goes down a little bit, and the reactive component, let me think. By the way, that makes it wants to be a little bit longer to bring the resistance back up. And the reactive component, I'm not sure. However, you brought up a very good point, Glenn, and that is you're setting a dipole some number of wavelengths above the ground. And we'd like to think that all the radiation of the dipole is going out there in space. A substantial amount of it is going straight down to the ground, reflecting off the ground, experiencing a 180-degree phase reversal as it reflects off the ground, and comes back to your dipole as a reflected wave. As you change the altitude of the antenna, the magnitude of what comes back goes up and down. Obviously, it gets bigger as you get closer to the ground. And the phase angle of what comes back changes. So altitude above the ground changes the resistor component and changes the reactive component. So there are certain magic distances above the ground where the antenna acts electronically lower or higher in frequency because of the phase angle that comes back, and it's also changing impedance. So altitude does change the impedance of a dipole, and it's part of your tuning procedure. John first, N2GYN. Go ahead, John.
Okay, another variable that I've noticed, when you're speaking about these analyzers, I'm assuming you're talking about something like MFJ cells, the combination frequency counter analyzer, capacitance resistance, that model. That's a very useful tool. Absolutely, I agree, very useful tool. But another variant that I've found is when using them for measurement, first of all, those things are putting out, my understanding, if I'm correct, less than a watt of power. They're actually transmitting less than a watt of power in order to get the visual or the standing wave and to show the reactance of the and resonance of the antenna. And if you use it and you find a particular frequency and say, okay, this is where it's dead flat, well, take that. Take it off the analyzer, put it into your radio, and now run 100 watts. Now tell me if it's exactly centered in the same frequency. Now go and turn on your legal limit amplifier and tell me if it's exactly in the same spot. I like your comment on that, Vic. And so do you mind.
Now, the MFJ analyzer and similar pieces of equipment, similar tools, very handy, but they're not perfect. I see some evidence by the little exposure I've had one of those. One of the guys at the salt mine owns one, and I've seen some measurements done with it. Nobody spends the time calibrating it. If you had a known good 50-ohm dummy load and you connected it to the analyzer while it's sweeping across your favorite band, will it measure one-to-one across the band? Then if you put a pair of good dummy loads on a T-connector, which is now 25 ohms, will it show 2-to-1 of standing wave ratio across your favorite band? And they deviate quite a bit. So there's an error factor in the antenna tuner, antenna analyzer. It gives you good information, but I'm going to guess it's got something like 5% error to it. It's giving you 95% accuracy is one way of looking at it. Stand by a minute.
Comment on that, Dick.
However, if your antenna is really a pure antenna, doesn't have any kind of funniness going on, by all the theory I know, when you measure its impedance at 1 watt, 10 watts, 1,000 watts, as long as nothing is heating up and changing characteristics, it's got to have the exact same standing wave ratio. All there's some exceptions. If there's a trap in the antenna and you're heating up the trap and it's changing its capacitance, inductance, or whatever, or the wire is getting hot and the resistive component is going up. Yep. But no reasonable antenna is going to change impedance as you change power going into it. Howie, go ahead. K2LIW. Wait for the beep.
All right. First of all, I have used the MFJ or had some people help me with it. One of the problems with the MFJ is you don't want to use it in a high RF field because if you, I took one of those things up. You're giving me weird readings, and we knew right away what it was. The hot carrier diode, whatever they're using, was sensing, was sensing RF. So it ain't a Sightmaster, and it's not a bird watt meter. It's good enough for certain applications, but you don't want to use it in a high RF field. But you know what, it gives you an idea as you're tuning it, it gives you an idea if you're going in the right direction. It'll tell you if you're going closer to resonance, because you could see, if you're getting better and better return loss. How far down can it look? What's the resolution? They claim 35 dBs, minus 35 dBm, minus 35 dBs, not dBm. And those things only put out about 5 to 10 milliwatts. They don't put out a lot, Dick. I don't think it gets down to 35. It's probably cooped down to about 1.1. Maybe, it's not a Sightmaster or an IFR if you're going to use it with a return bridge. Okay, my question was for QIQ. When you are using horizontal dipoles, 75-ohm dipole, and you use a 50-ohm one-to-one balance, you are able to get the 75-ohm the dipole to match to a, close to a one-to-one through the 50-ohm cable?
Yes, it was, Howie, and generally just by adjusting the length, and usually most of the time it drops right in. That's with wire antennas, but I think you're asking about doing something with antennas other than wire. Am I correct on that? Which there may be some other things you have to look into.
Well, I am going to be using dipoles, but these are going to be made, these are going to be pipe, you know, pipe pipe with an inner pipe held together using hose clamps, you know, T-64-inch, you know, 1-inch, and then you have another pipe that goes in and you can slide it in and out. That's what we're going to, what I'm going to be using. So the antennas that I'm working on right now are going to be dipoles or inverted Vs, but they're going to be aircraft aluminum. So I don't think that should have an effect, even though that they have a diameter. I mean, the only thing you might worry about is from time to time to change of the day, if you have any humidity that gets inside the pipe. Go ahead, QIQ.
I think as long as you have enough adjustment length inside those tubes, it should work. Granted, you know, here on 6 meters, I think overall it'll be close, Howie. You may not get a perfect match, but something tells me that as long as you match both sides as you when you're lengthening it and just, you know, keep on going back and forth on both sides and measure it out as you're moving it along, I think you'll have some pretty good results. You know, you may have to add a capacitor or something, but I really don't think so. I think just by adjusting the length, you'll find a match with the Balun. The only other thing, too, is that at 50 megahertz, you may want to watch how the connections are made from the Balun, you know, to those tubes and keep those lengths short, you know, and, you know, mechanically connect that Balun very, very tight, you know, without a lot of extra lead length in that area. You know, it's going to be not. It's going to be a little bit more critical than, say, doing something at 80 meters.
Absolutely. It's not for 6. It's for 10 meters. I was thinking about using an inline Balun. You know, a Balun has two SO239s on it, and just using a jumper cable right up to the pipe and just use lugs. All right, but Dick, on the MFJ, you got to be very careful. Those things will get affected. If you have a, you know, transmitters or other RF fields around, or if you have, you know, if your antenna's picking up a field, you've got to realize, and you have to be smart enough to know that you have an issue with your readings. Go ahead, Dick.
Did you want?
John recognized, and that makes sense, since that antenna analyzer, I think, is running at the milliwatt level. If the signal coming in the antenna from some other source during the period of your measurement is in the microwatt level, it's going to disturb your readings. And there's probably various techniques by which you can find out how much disturbance you're getting. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, okay. Two things. One, my experience using an MFJ, when finding what it calls center frequency or its lowest SWR, and then hooking it up to a HF radio, putting in excess of 100 watts, the center frequency changes. Now, is that due to the heat buildup, a heat factor, the quality of the coax, there's several factors. But in a perfect world, Dick, you're right, it should be the same. But I tell you, in practical experience, it is not. That's the first comment. The other one is a question, and I posed this to you the other night when we were at field day. By the way, I really enjoyed our conversation. But my question is, most sold today are current Baluns, and that seems to be the overwhelming agreement, way to go, is with a current Balun. But my question was, and was this last night, when would a voltage Balun be better to use than a current Balun? In other words, what application could there be with an antenna that a voltage Balun would be more suitable
than a current balance. So I'd like to throw that out. Answer, do you want to just...
When it comes to the change of the standing wave ratio of your antenna as you feed more power into it, you've mentioned a number of factors, John, but you forgot the most important one, and that is the instrumentation that's measuring the visuar. You take any of the commercially available standing wave ratio tools that you and I have got hands on. Bird wattmeter is one of the better ones. In other words, by measuring forward and reverse power with a Bird wattmeter and going direct chart, I can measure standing wave ratio. But a lot of them are a lot worse than that. Many of our power amplifiers have a standing wave ratio bridge network built in. You can measure forward and reverse power that the power amplifier is seeing on its output connector. In order for that to be telling you the truth, let me drop. At least two things are required. Number one, that bridge network must be well balanced, must have high directivity. When it's in the forward mode, it should read nothing but forward power. When it's in reverse mode, it should read nothing but reverse power. Most of them only have a medium quality measurement of that. Second of all, when you make that assessment of how well it's balanced for forward and reverse power, because you're using diode rectifiers to measure that forward and reverse power, and as you rectify a bigger or smaller voltage, the capacitance of the diode changes. Every diode has C-swing. As you change the voltage on the diode, its equivalent capacitance changes. Therefore, the balance of that bridge network is changing versus power. You take any of your visuar measuring devices that you've got into a perfect 50-ohm dummy load and go up and down in power, you might not see it. But if you intentionally made a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio by putting two 50-ohm dummy loads in parallel through a T-connector and a couple of pieces of cable of equal length, the length of the cable doesn't matter in that particular case, and now you go up and down in power, the 2-to-1 visuar of your dummy load will look like it's going up and down. If your dummy load is rated for a kilowatt and you're only putting 500 watts into each of a pair of kilowatt dummy loads, they're not changing. And you're doing it for a brief period of time. You're not heating them up. You do that experiment with a known 2-to-1 visuar of a known non-changing thing, like a pair of dummy loads in parallel. You'll see the apparent visuar go up and down versus power. It's your bridge causing that, John, not the antenna. N2GYN, K2LIW. I've seen that quite often.
Yeah, it's almost like, will the real SWR please stand up? Because I wondered, is the real SWR measurement more accurate with the instrument or with the meter, the watt meter, SWR meter, that's in my radio? And it is different. It is different, and I contributed to the fact of the analyzer putting out several milliwatts only, and a radio putting out much more power, which is going to subject materials to heat, and so on and so forth. Yeah, the second part of the question, if you could throw out there to maybe to QIQ or whoever, I want to know when, if ever, a voltage balun is superior to use than a current balun. I can't get an answer to this. Answer, do you want?
A current balun is a kind of idealization. And if you truly have a current balun, that means the output connector, the plus and minus lead, the outer conductor in the shield, so to speak, are thoroughly floating from ground. Therefore, that's a rather ideal balun. Right now, I don't know of a case where a voltage balun is better. See what Glenn's got to say about that. KC2QIQ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Dick, I'm on an HT right now. Am I making the repeater?
You're making it beautiful. I got the new antenna. Go ahead, Glenn.
I guess, I think for some of the lower frequencies, depending on how the balun is constructed, I use voltage baluns for let's see, 40 and 80 meters, and I've constructed them out of basically toroids and using non-coax, actually building them almost like transformers, and had very, very good results down there with that. and I just get very, very high galvanic isolation. So basically what happens is the antenna, if it ever got struck with lightning or anything, it's completely isolated like a transformer from my transceiver. So that's one benefit that I can think of. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
Okay, from what I'm sensing then, that your particular voltage balance really has the equivalent of a primary winding and a secondary winding. In that case, isn't it identical to a voltage balance and a current balance simultaneously? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, in that analysis, yeah, you could make that, you know, what do you want to do, your evidence, you Norton? How do you want to analyze it? But I think overall the reason I'm calling it the voltage balance in that particular case is because of the true galvanic isolation, Dick. And that's the benefit that I see there.
Yeah, very few of the balance are really quite that isolated, with a real primary winding, a real secondary winding, hooked together by the toroid or whatever, so that they're really floating from each other. And the word floating is also relative, Glenn. If you really did get struck with lightning, which might be a megavolt strike, that would have no trouble arcing from that primary to that secondary. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, why?
Mel recognized. Glenn first.
I look at it this way, Dick. Whenever I'm grounding for lightning, I can ground all of my structures, my towers, I can ground everything, and put the currents or the bleed-off areas for lightning in the areas where I want them to be. So in other words, if there's any charge surrounding my house during a storm, those are the areas that are bleeding off lightning. I'm not looking for a strike. A strike is a total loss. But before a strike happens, there's always charge. And as long as the charge is being bled off and it's going into those grounds, that's great. And then the coaxial cable that's coming into the house looks like an open circuit with respect to the nice big grounded towers and everything else outside the house. Chances are that won't be the path that gets struck. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
Interesting philosophy, and I see where you're going. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. The reason that voltage balance sort of fell out of the industry, or you don't see them advertised, in other words, a lot of these companies that sell balance only sell current balance. Now, why? I looked into this, and I looked, what is really the difference between a voltage balance and a current balance? The problem is, with a voltage balance, one of the windings appears across the line directly. So what happens if you don't have sufficient impedance? A common problem when winding these things, the lower frequency end of the range of the balance, the SWR becomes degraded. So you will not get the broadbanding effect with a voltage balance like you would with a current balance under the same circumstances. Basically, there's why voltage balance are not being sold the way they used to, Dick. Over.
EC2QAQ with a comment?
You got it, Glenn.
Mel, one of the things I have to tell you about this, because I've built quite a few of them, and basically for the lower frequency end is where I am using them, and I can tell you that there are materials out there, companies called Magnetic Sync in Pennsylvania. They make a material called P material, 2500 perm, and when you put like 25 or 30 turns of wire across a 2500 permeability material, you're going to wind up with like near a millihenry or more of inductance. Now, when you talk about, you know, 80 meters, megahertz, you know, there's no magnetization current whatsoever inside there, so it has like almost no effect on the match of the antenna in that area. There are other concerns. How do you get the coupling? The coupling is probably the bigger area where you have to worry. But as far as the overall inductance, you know, primary inductance, if that's what you're worried about, any of those materials down there usually work really, really good for ferrites. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And the antenna, remember, has to be symmetrical. Any imbalance in the antenna is one of the things a voltage balance demanded. Symmetrical antennas. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I have the impression that Glenn is willing to use the right materials, a big enough volume of them. He's not trying to make it inexpensive. He's not trying to make it small. And from that criteria, his voltage balance has all the bandwidth he can use. Is that approximately what's going on, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn.
Correct. I would imagine that if somebody had to buy something like that, if they didn't build it on their own and know the materials, it costs hundreds of dollars to build a balun like that. Some of my favorite baluns, which are current baluns, are made by like DX Engineering, which are great. I use them on my beams, you know, mount them up on big structures, and you know, they're going to be much less expensive, and they do a very good job. But down at 40 and 80, where I really want the isolation in that area, I have a specific purpose for that. So. But it is, I would imagine that if you had to build something like that, you know, or buy it, it would probably be very, very expensive.
Can I say one more thing, Dick?
Go ahead. I've got a comment for John. You got it, Mel.
A lot of experiments. Now, I did some experiments with, I could say, I didn't have the exotic materials, but just to see some of the effects of voltage balance. And I found that one of the things, the antenna really has to be somewhat, not only symmetrical, but if you go ahead and use a voltage balance, and the antenna is, it has to be actually balanced in respect to this ground. In other words, if it's sloping and it's changing its affinities to the ground potential, if it's, in other words, its voltage balance does not work right. It works right only under very good circumstances, Dick, over.
I'm going to agree with you, Glenn. Mel, I'm going to tell you where a voltage balun was for me an advantage. I was operating on a small printed circuit transmitter. I was operating at 900 megacycles, feeding a pure dipole made out of the printed circuit board itself. So if I did a good job of laying out the dipole, it was a balanced antenna. The transmitter itself was a very unbalanced structure. It was an integrated circuit with a 50-ohm output impedance going to the ground of the PC board. And I used a voltage balun for a very good reason. It didn't have to have any windings of ferrite and toroids and whatever. The voltage balun consisted of a pair of L networks. One L network gave 90 degrees of phase lead that fed the left-hand side of the dipole. The other L network gave 90 degrees of phase lag that fed the right-hand side of the dipole. So that pair of L networks was a thoroughly balanced voltage balun, which did not launch any excess current into the printed circuit board if and only if the dipole itself was a thoroughly balanced structure. The antenna was a balanced structure, which we were carefully, making sure that we did. The advantage is it was an extremely simple baluning structure consisting of four surface-mounted miniaturized inductors and capacitors, two inductors and two capacitors. Very simple network that did the job. So in that case, a voltage balun was the right way to go because it was small, cheap, and adequate. It's not ideal. I wouldn't have to worry about whether or not the two halves of the dipole were thoroughly balanced if I was using a current balun. But in that case, it was a nice, simple network. That's about the only place I know of that it's a real advantage, John. N2GYN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, does it need a trifilar winding?
No fancy winding, just four surface mount ordinary inductors and two capacitors. Four surface mount components with the right layout, and the problem went away. You got it, John.
Yeah, okay. N2GYN. Well, the reason I bring this up is, of course, 40 meters, 80 meters, for the last 20, 30 years, I've heard this argument, you know, back and forth from many hams, many that I actually respect, too. And certain ones will swear you have to use a voltage balun. Others will, you know, say no, you got to go with a current balun. And I can never get a definitive answer. 30 years of looking, I can't get a definitive answer. But it seems here, then, from what I'm getting, the consensus, if I'm understanding everybody's comments. The whole concept of a voltage balun, for the most part, shouldn't even exist. Never consider one, or almost never consider one. and always go with a voltage balun. That's sort of what I'm getting from the consensus here. And I can tell you, get on 4080 and speak to what I would call a lot of the old timers, which I'm getting to be one soon too. But they're very, very adamant on their theory of you have to go with voltage balun. No, you got to go with a current balun. So I guess I don't know. I never had. That's one I'll never be satisfied with the answer, I guess. So, but thank you very much for everybody's input on it. NCGYN, back in
there. KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think one of the problems you find on 80 meters, I'll probably get yelled at by someone for this one, but is that you'll find that half the people over there that are talking about voltage balance and current balance may not really know what the difference is. I hate to say that, but that's opinion of mine. And/or the other thing too is that in a lot of applications you find down there is that when somebody finds something that they eventually get to work, and some of those bands are not the easiest bands to get on 80 meters and get a good strong signal. And when they finally find something that works, whatever it is when they're done, that all of a sudden is the only thing that works, if you know what I'm saying. And that's, I find common on that band. But back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Sounds right, Glenn. Another way of looking at this, if you've only got partial knowledge, unfortunately human nature is such that everybody is an expert. By way of hook or by crook and us all discussing it, we're slowly gaining a little more knowledge on the subject. This was TechNet number 1303 of the series that began in September of 1982, 27 and a half years ago. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll be discussing all of this jazz next week, and we'll find a few more of Mother Nature's truths. Hopefully we'll dispel a couple of more of the myths. We're trying. Bye-bye. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW, clear but listening.
Roger, Dick. Well, between us, a whole 100 years of experience, we still get the mysteries, in antennas especially. All right, final word. A voltage balun, I've gone through this, as Glenn said, on 75. A voltage balun and a current balun, yep, serves a purpose, and the purpose that Dick needed, a voltage balun, ideal. A current balun is more forgiving. That's the bottom line. Easier to work with, don't have these confines and everything. If you can have a simple situation where you can use two simple, as I explained last week, basically two L networks to fool with that vertical, basically you are using a voltage balun in that particular case. But for people that are going to go buy, put up a dipole, and they buy one of these baluns that sticks in the middle, cheap from Radio Works and whatever, it's a current balun, works real well, and that's the bottom line. With that, I'll say 73 for all, and see you all next week, hopefully. This is K2KEY saying good night.
K2KEY, WD2HWW, Mel.
Hey, first, anybody want to make any final words before I say hello to Howie? Hey, Howie, you got the floor.
I hope you had a good week, Mel. Just wanted to say hello. I think I left you a message a day or two ago. You going to be around tomorrow sometime in the afternoon?
Oh, back to work tomorrow. Got to earn a living tomorrow, Howie. I may have, if this other guy shows up for class and I don't have the stuff, that means I most likely, yeah, I think I may have Thursday afternoon off, Howie, over.
No, what I'm going to do is I'll try to call you Monday night. We can talk a little bit, maybe we can get together. What's a good time for me to call you?
Boy, good time. I would say tomorrow night, you have the dinner, around 8. Yeah, around 8-ish should be okay, Howie, if you're free.
Thank you for visiting the Far Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear. So I don't know if she has anything planned. You know, the weeks are fairly filled up this weekend, of course, with completely filled with the field day operation, of course, and all. So my so-called account, my ham radio spare time account, gets kind of low. I don't have that much time, spare time usually to, you know, do other things other than take care of, you know, work and then, of course, social situations with the XYL. So, possibility good Thursday. Let me let it drop. Let me ask. I think she's sleeping. Hold on.
I go up. Oh, I'll speak to you Monday. I'll speak to you Monday evening around 8, and we'll see about, you know, sometime that week. We'll talk on the phone. You don't have to wake her up, Mel.
Oh, I would never wake her up, that's for sure. You don't leave, you know, as I said, you don't pull a sleeping tiger by the tail. Don't wake the sleeping tiger. But, the point is, I'll ask her, of course, tomorrow. If Thursday, I told her I may be free, but she says she had something planned, so that means I may be free completely on the Thursday afternoon. So I'll let you know. Like I say, speak to you tomorrow night. Have a good night's rest, Howie. I've got to get some rest myself. I had a full day today with field day and yesterday also, so I'm really sort of pooped out, over.
Absolutely. Give me a call tomorrow evening. Yeah, I need to know like a day in advance. Alright, I'll call you tomorrow night. I can even email you. Alright, you have a great evening or morning. WB2HWW. Good night.
Hey, Howie, take care.
WB2HWW, clear. Line mark.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Always got great information, and Mel and Dick, the leaders of this TechNet, and they've covered very interesting subjects.
Oh, real good, real good. Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that. I had a few things going on here at the house tonight, and I didn't have a chance to check in there. But, yeah, real good.